Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Medical Minds Conversations with Guthrie Experts. I'm Steve Ostrous, joined by Dr. Corinne Johnston. And today is an exciting topic for both of us and for everyone, I'm sure. We are talking about colon cancer screening, which is incredibly important. And this is, of course, in March, colorectal cancer awareness month.
Yeah. And it is, Steve. I feel like I'm in primary care. So I am consistently urging my patients who fall into the age range to get their colon cancer screening. And, you know, you'll get no's for different reasons. And sometimes they don't want to tell you. So I did a quick Google to see, you know, why don't people get their colon cancer screenings? And number one was they just don't have time. But number two was fear or stigma. Fear or stigma of the screening, or maybe perhaps of having a bowel movement.
Yeah, it's not what people, I guess, want to talk about outside of their loved ones or even with their loved ones.
Yes, it is. I think there are certain age ranges where we talk about bowel movements all the time, you know, in the early stages of life and the end stages of life. Although I think I told you in another setting, you know, I always tell my patients, it's okay, we're going to talk about poop today. And it's all right, because I have two young kids, and that's what we talk about. So I looked up a little word of the day for us today, and that is parcopresis, which is the fear of pooping, also known as shy bowel, which I think probably colonoscopy preps are some of people's concerns.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny you say that, because I think a lot of us can probably relate to the fact, like, you know, if we have that long road trip coming up, for instance, and everyone's kind of concerned about using a public restroom. So I think for whatever reason, you know, maybe it's kind of like, you know, if you have your body clock, even if you forget to set your alarm, but you still wake up at the right time, it's almost like you've told your body, hey, I'm not using a public restroom for several hours, so you're just going to have to work with me on this and make sure I don't need to.
Yep. It's yours. And then when you're a kid, it's your parents, right? This car is not stopping until we get there.
All right. Well, joining us now is Dr. Nicholas Cerniak, and he is a colorectal and general surgeon. Thanks, Dr. Cerniak, for being here today. You know, obviously, your background is super important, as it is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month in March. I guess let's kind of start at the beginning. What does that even mean when someone hears colorectal?
Sure. Thank you guys for having me. And what a time to kind of align with the message here. So, yeah, it's a question I often get when I think a new patient is referred to me, and there may not be a clear cut, you know, understanding of why that is. But yeah, I'm formally trained in colorectal and anal surgery, which really is a focus of the, you know, gastrointestinal stomach tract that really occupies the last portion of the intestine. So the colon is the large intestine. The rectum is that part that, you know, holds on to bowel movements before you excrete them. And then the anus is that part you can see from the bottom. Mm-hmm. So ultimately it's just one very specialized bladder for excrement. And there are some very unique challenges, both, you know, benign and malignant, that can occur in this area. So we try to focus all of our talents and energy to correct those issues.
We know that March is obviously a significant time. People should be screened at all times. You know, we say March, it's a special awareness month, but we always try to say in the medical field, that doesn't mean you need to wait for March. So if you could talk a little bit about screening, the process, you know, right down from ages of screening and who should go in to be screened. And then I guess from there, we can talk about the different types of screenings.
Yeah, sure. So one important distinction to kind of make, and this is both for maybe patients kind of reflecting on their own family trees, or, you know, providers, practitioners, when they're trying to assess a patient who may be due for screening, by virtue of age or symptoms, that sort of thing, is what is the generalized risk assessment of a patient? Now, I find in my own personal experience, when I ask a question about, hey, has anybody else in your family ever had, you know, colon cancer, rectal cancer, you know, other, you know, polyps or things like that, I find often that people don't really talk, even amongst their family members, about, you know, yeah. did grandpa have colon cancer or this mm-hmm. or that? You know, sometimes it just gets lumped into, oh, there was a tumor in his belly, or he had intestinal cancer, which yeah. may have some nuance to it. But trying to get a good sense, both as a patient of your, you know, your siblings, your parents, your aunts, your uncles, I mean, a practitioner to really hammer that out may clue us in on, you know, is this patient what's considered average risk, mm-hmm. or are they a higher risk patient, which may modify the age at which a colonoscopy should be, you know, recommended to start versus just the run of the mill, you know, a patient who is just coming in for a wellness physical. So average risk versus a non-average risk or high risk patient is an important distinction to make. So my first message for patients is, you know, talk to your family. If you're not estranged and you're not adopted, it is worth having a conversation to understand, you know, what your family's made of, because that may really benefit you down the line. You know, knowledge is power in this sense. So for average risk individuals, you know, the traditional guideline was at 50 years old, you start getting your colonoscopy. And I think that was played up in popular culture and, you know, sitcoms and things like that. But over the past 5 years or so, that age was actually lowered to 45 years old for average risk individuals. And there are multiple preventative task forces out there, you know, the Society of Colorectal Surgeons, Society of Gastro, you know, Intestinal Providers, you know, that's the one thing we can agree on universally is 45 is the new 50. Now, if nothing is found, you know, get it every 10 years. So this isn't a yearly thing, and it's not super cumbersome in the grand scheme of things, you know, aside from the day that patients have to take off work and maybe do a bowel clean out and, you know, have a formal colonoscopy. But, you know, the other options may exist that we'll delve into. But going to the higher risk individuals, that age at which you may start, you know, that could be as young as you adolescents or teenagers, depending mm-hmm. on, you know, the pedigree of the family and whether or not we feel there's a genetic, you know, profile or proclivity for this to happen. Because there are a fair amount of inherited syndromes that do run generation to generation to generation mm-hmm. That really can increase the risk 7 to 10-fold, you know, just based on that average risk individual. So mm-hmm. again, you know, it may be a little bit more modifiable for, you know, family A to family B, but getting a good idea of where to start is very important.
Yeah. And that decrease in age, right? Because that's one that we've had kind of different guidances sometimes about mammograms, or like you said, mm-hmm. we can't all agree on mammograms, but we're agreeing on this and saying 45. And the main reason for that was more cancers in younger patients, correct?
That is correct. And, you know, I think Chadwick Boseman, you know, the famous actor, Black Panther, Marvel, mm-hmm. you know, universe, he kind of kept it hidden for so long and eventually succumbed to it, unfortunately. But he's a, you know, the most, I think, readily available, you know, star that was, you know, he was not, you know, even, you know, close to 50 years old and was already, you know, it was too far gone for it to really be dealt with. So there are projections out there that suggest by the year 2030, 2035, that the, you know, a fair chunk, if not 30%, are going to be people under 45. Wow. And I know my own experience, I've had the opportunity to treat people my own age. I'll tell you right now, it's less than 45. And these were people that don't really have a particular genetic predilection to have this. But we are seeing these things occur a lot sooner, a lot more often, which is an unfortunate scenario. The whole why that may be different, you know, maybe different topic, but I don't think it's going to magically, you know, shift back to what we saw 20 years ago as far as the demographics.
Yeah.
Are you finding it's quite surprising when you have to have these conversations with some of the younger people who just totally shocked by the news?
Yeah, there is a lot of denial. And you know, we have to be sensitive and thoughtful in the way that we approach this, because we know that trying to get people directed to or get patients directed to the appropriate treatments in a very efficient fashion really, you know, may have a positive impact on their long-term outcome. However, we do want to leave some room for, you know, for acceptance and for understanding. But it is not an easy conversation to have because people think it was just hemorrhoids or people think it was just something they ate and, you know, they had a bad GI bug that just kind of lingered along and they were having, you know, pain, diarrhea, blood in their bowel movements, those sort of things. Just they get kind of written off on some people who are otherwise, you know, young, healthy people that are working and just going about life trying to, you know, move forward. So it really is a, you know, punch in the gut for some people because it's not what we traditionally thought was the thing that would start to affect us in our prime of our lives. But certainly environmental factors and potentially things that we've, you know, where we were raised, you know, zip code, the things that we, you know, ate for the vast majority of our lives, processed foods, fast foods, you know, smoking, all that. You know, that may have had an additive effect on this and maybe unlocked that potential that we had, unfortunately.
Yeah. I feel like as we talk about screening, so I feel like there's a lot of misconceptions around colonoscopies. And I'm sure throughout your training, you get a lot of the same questions I do. Are they going to put me to sleep? Does it hurt? You know, those sort of things. So talking about colonoscopy, walking someone through that, what does that look like? What is the fear? You know, what do they see?
Sure. So I tend to spend more time, believe it or not, really going through what the bowel prep, you know, kind of would be like, because most of the folks that I speak to, even the morning of and before the colonoscopy or even afterwards in the office reviewing results or over the phone, what have you, the prep seems to be the most miserable part. And miserable may be a stretch of a word, but it's the word that I kind of use to oversell it in a way, because essentially most people that are, you know, in their, you know, 40s, 50s, they're working, they have a family, they have responsibilities, and not only are they taking a day off to have the procedure done, but often, you know, at the very least a half day has to be committed to starting to cleanse out the bowel. Now, traditionally, I explained to them, it used to be a, you know, 2-gallon jug of fluid, it tasted terrible. And you had to sort of slug that down, and some people got nauseous and upset stomach, they couldn't finish, you know, dealing with a lot of the side effects of just consuming a lot of a higher electrolyte solution. But a lot of the new protocols are always coming out, and there are alternatives to these things that I explain to people, you know, sometimes it's a handful of pills a couple times, sometimes it's some proprietary formulations that may cost a little bit of money out of pocket. Sometimes it's as simple as, you know, a bottle of cold Gatorade and a couple packets of Miralax, depending on, you know, your health status. So there is some wiggle room with trying to prep somebody. But I do explain to them that, hey, listen, there is going to, because you're awake for the prep. You know, you're conscious for that and you have to be close to a restroom. So we definitely go through some strategies to kind of optimize that little part of the experience. Now, the procedure itself, and I speak from my experience, but I also know how other locations and other departments may accomplish them. You know, they're typically done with some form of sedation, whether or not that is, you know, conscious sedation, you know, or formal anesthesia administered by an anesthesiologist. So there is a little bit of variance depending on the location and the resources available. But for the most part, patients tend not to remember even things that were said in the, you know, immediate minutes before the scope is even started. Some of that chit chat, nervous chatter, banter. And I'll tell you that a lot of patients that I would even disclose some good news to after a scope don't even remember that after it's all done. So I always speak to a significant other or whoever's there to let them know. But It's more the exception than the rule, even with the lightest sedation available, that patients really do recall some sort of negative experience. I find that most patients that do do fall into some category of maybe recreational marijuana use or a pretty regular alcohol use, things that may make them more resistant to these types of medications. So it's something that I try to screen out early on to make sure an appropriate, you know, sedation plan is rendered. So we're not having patients kind of have these bad experiences that would otherwise maybe make them less likely to have one down the line if it was appropriate. Because we certainly do see that in the hospital all the time. You know, a patient may come in, get admitted, have something found, and why didn't you have a colonoscopy in the past? Well, I had one 20 years ago and it was a bad experience, so I felt I was okay without it. So sometimes, you know, getting snake bitten once could hurt you down the line. So, you know, it's kind of the responsibility is on individuals like myself and gastroenterology to really make it a positive experience, so that there isn't that sort of resistance. And I think it really all starts with setting that expectation up front, as opposed to saying, all right, I'm going to send you for a colonoscopy, you're going to drink a prep, you show up and you go to work the next day after the colonoscopy. I think, over explaining it sometimes really lets the patient understand and their expectations are then, okay, it's not going to be fun, it's necessary, maybe sore, but, you know, there's a means to an end.
Yeah, I think you said two really important things, the key and on, or that with that is one, that honesty with your care provider, right, to say, I do abuse marijuana, right? Mm-hmm. Or I do consume an amount of alcohol. It's much like knowing your family history, right?
Yeah.
We're not looking at it to shame you. We're looking at it to provide your best care. And then that most people, you know, don't remember. And I think, you know, I have two friends or more who have gone through it and told us that, you know, their smartwatch the rest of the day, they got the best sleep they'd gotten in 15 years,
you
know? So there are some added benefits maybe that we're not thinking about.
Right. Yeah. And you mentioned benefits, and I think that's a pretty fine segue into, you know, something that Steve may have mentioned. You know, the colonoscopy, it's sort of the Everest. It's the peak of what we can offer. And when I counsel patients, it's not often that I counsel patients on the alternatives to colonoscopy, because most often I'm sort of the endpoint. I'm seeing them because something was not right with the colonoscopy or what have you. But a colonoscopy, the real reason I think it does all the heavy lifting, or it should, is because we've gotten pretty good at them. The preps have gotten pretty tolerable, but they offer the best of both worlds in that they are, you know, what we say is diagnostic and often therapeutic, which means that they will directly be able to diagnose something, not just like it could be this or that. We can do a biopsy right then and there, take photographs, really have an idea. And therapeutic in the sense that, hey, that we find a precancerous polyp or something that seems like it's out of place, we can often treat it, you know, treat bleeding, we can treat hemorrhoids sometimes, we can treat early cancers most often. And, it's all just one shot, as opposed to some of the other alternatives that are out there, you know, the what's called a FIT test or a Cologuard test, or some virtual colonoscopies. If they find anything that is not 100% normal, it's going to reflex you, you know, to a colonoscopy anyway. So maybe, you know, there is this, cut out the middleman, so to speak. But the colonoscopy tends to be what we consider the gold standard. And I tell patients, why do we call it that? Because it is the test that all others are compared to. So, you know, you have that template of knowledge there, and then all the rest of the tests are just trying to be, you know, for lack of a better term, an imitator. Mm-hmm. But they do have their pros, you know, their ups and downs, downsides.
So they're, like you said, they are options, and I guess something is better than nothing. But to your point, with the colonoscopy, you're going to be able to find so much more. Can you talk, and you mentioned polyps and things like that, can you talk a little bit more specifically about what you're looking for and what types of things you find during the colonoscopy?
Right. So there are standards of practice that exist globally, nationwide, to guide individuals who do colonoscopies to be able to reproduce their results? Because some people may ask, you know, if Dr. X and Dr. Y do colonoscopies on opposite ends of the country, are they apples and apples or apples and oranges? Well, colonoscopies are, in order to get, you know, trained well and feel comfortable, you really have to follow the guidelines of performing a high quality colonoscopy. So what we're looking for is, number one, we want to make sure the prep is good. You know, sometimes if the prep is not good, the potential for missing even small early polyps or cancers could go up, could be obscured by some of this, you know, organic material, liquid, sticky stool that's in there. So we have to make a decision if the prep is good enough, first of all. So sometimes, you know, going through a 20, 30, 40 minute colonoscopy, depending on, you know, how difficult it is, it may not even be worth it to the patient if the prep is the prep is not great. So first and foremost, we're trying to make sure the prep is good enough. Secondly, we're trying to ensure that we're making it all the way through the colon. So we have certain landmarks and points of anatomic interest that we have to, you know, at least identify and ideally document that we are doing a full colonoscopy. Because anybody, I tell people, talk is cheap. I want to see the pictures. Because that's the evidence that we really need to make sure that we're doing high quality colonoscopies. And then we're taking our time. We're taking that scope from essentially the starting point of the colon all the way to the exit point, very slowly looking around every nook and cranny under every, you know, fold and twist to really make sure that we're not leaving anything behind. So these things, like I mentioned, you know, can take 15 minutes, they can take 40 minutes, depending on if things are found, because we're looking for inflammation. We're looking for distortion amongst the lining of the colon, which is a very, very distinctive look. We're looking for a little growth, almost like a mushroom or a wart, something like that, that we can, you know, remove and send off as a biopsy. So that's what the whole point really is for these screening colonoscopies, are to find things early to deal with them right then and there before they become much more difficult and risky to deal with, which can sometimes mean, you know, if it's a cancer, a surgery, chemotherapy, you know, sometimes unnecessary, unwanted procedures down the line. So dealing with it early and on your own terms really makes things most often very short term. But that's the whole purpose and what we're looking for in the colonoscopy. Just to make sure that we do it the same way every time, that we make the judgment that this is good to be confident we haven't missed something, and we're kind of letting you go out there with you know, this false hope or false optimism. But ultimately, everybody practices by these guidelines, ideally.
Yeah. So if you're the patient that's not going to do the colonoscopy because they can't take the day and a half of work, or they're just not going to do it, and they're low risk, like you said, these are folks who were just doing screenings on, you talked about two other tests, and they look at different things.
Yeah. There exist, you know, different ways of trying to, I guess, imitate and replicate what a colonoscopy mm-hmm. does. The one that I think is probably most familiar with individuals of colonoscopy screening age at this point is probably the Cologuard test. See the commercials on, you know, nightly news or early in the morning.
The dancing bowel.
Yeah. And you know, as a colon surgeon, you know, I'm biased. You know, I think colonoscopy is the greatest thing. It's the you know, best way to kill two birds with one stone. Mm-hmm. But I had a mentor tell me, you know, any screening is better than no screening.
Yeah.
Because ideally, to try and detect something early, or at least have that warning sign, mm-hmm. that early warning flag, really does maybe prompt people to take things seriously. So I tell people, you know, family even, hey, if you do something, it's better than just living with your head in the sand. So the Cologuard test is interesting because it kind of takes from some older tests that we used to, you know, really used to hang our hat on. I remember when I was in medical school, we got really hammered on, you know, primary care screening tests and ages and what was available for colon cancer. And essentially the older tests just look for blood in the stool. And that's all it looked for. It looked for iron in the stool. And, you know, that could be falsely elevated by if you ate red meat, if you have a hemorrhoid, things like that. So, I mean, that was just looking for, you know, blood. Then they kind of increased that sensitivity with what's called the FIT test, the fecal immunochemical test, which looked for particular molecules that are only present in, you know, human blood, human hemoglobin. So that got a little bit more, you know, specific and became kind of this new thing that was, you know, an annual test that was an alternative, just looking for blood. But again, this could be blood from a lot of places. But the Cologuard really kind of married a whole bunch of modern science together, and it's taken that FIT technology, and it's also coupling along molecules. This is a DNA test that not only looks for blood in the stool, but looks for particular DNA sequences, DNA combinations that are known to exist within colon cancer, most colon cancers, or polyps that are kind of on their way to getting big and turning into colon cancer. We call them advanced polyps. Mm-hmm. So this like really got much more specific, and you know, when this really comes back positive, it really, you know, has a pretty reasonable estimation of what you're going to find on colonoscopy. But the Cologuard really, I think, is probably the next best thing out there because of how specific it could be. Now, I've had people have positive Cologuards, and we do their colonoscopy, and we don't find anything. And there is that, you know, 6 to 8% chance to false positive. What do we do with that information? And how do we, you know, tell people to screen moving forward? You know, that's a moving target. It's hard to say, but often I tell people, well, you had a false positive. Can you trust this moving forward? Should you just get colonoscopies? Probably, but I don't think there is a firm answer on that per se. But I think, you know, being a little bit overprotective with these things is probably in the patient's best interest. But I also mentioned the virtual colonoscopy, which is essentially a CT scan of the colon. But hey, guess what? You still have to prep for it.
Yeah.
I hate to tell you this, but they have to blow up your colon somehow. So it's very often you may get a little bit of air or carbon dioxide blown up your rear end to make the colon big for the 10 minutes you're in the CAT scanner. So what sounds really cool and AI really
it doesn't isn't. Sound cool to me at all.
So it may even be more miserable than a colonoscopy. So, you know, those are used in very select circumstances. But that's really fallen out of potential, you know,
there was a president, there's a lot of traction. I remember reading, got in the news, like president gets virtual colonoscopy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
I think I'll take the 40-minute nap.
Yeah, really. Going,
oh, it's naps all day sometimes afterwards, Steve. I think those are great points. Yeah.
How quick, you mentioned that it's almost immediate, but how quick are the results usually when it comes to a colonoscopy?
Yeah. So the information that's rendered sometimes varies with what was removed, how much was removed, you know, how much was removed or biopsied. It also may depend on the place that is processing the sample. You know, some maybe small hospitals may have staff that really takes their time or doesn't have staff to really have a high throughput with specimen analysis. But I tell patients it's an average of probably a week for the typical specimens that would be removed from a colonoscopy. Could be quicker, could be longer. I try to tell people, do not worry if it's taking longer than what I tell you. It does not necessarily mean they are, you know, it's being second opinion, being sent out for further analysis. It just may be more tissue or a challenging week in the, you know, the processing area. But it typically does take, you know, several days to look at. And they're looking at a lot of things because under the microscope, you know, they want to have a really good idea of whether or not, you know, this is something that changes the conversation and the, you know, path forward for patients. So we do appreciate when they're very thorough and methodical.
Yeah. I think people need to think about that as well. You know, when you're from the primary care counseling standpoint, if you're an anxious person, if you tend to really worry and you choose to do that FIT test, which is having a bowel movement essentially and mailing it, right? There are a few times I always tell my patients that we're allowed to mail our poop and it's not illegal, you know, but this is your chance. But if you're an anxious person and that comes back positive and then you're waiting for a procedure, which may be a couple weeks out, that's a lot of angst, right? Whereas if you're waiting, maybe it's all good news on a colonoscopy the day of, or you're waiting 3 to 7 days for biopsy results. Sure.
Yeah. That's a fair point. You kind of have a binary there. Yeah. Yes. No. Is it, you know, should you be worried? Should you not be? Yeah. But, never thought of it that way.
So I think you may be the first surgeon we've had on so far in the episodes that we've done, of the podcast. Can you talk a little bit about, and I know it's obviously not about you, but the feeling you get, you know, obviously we want to have all positive results, but you know, as the person who can get the ball rolling on treatment and hopeful eventual successful treatment.
Yeah. The one thing I try to, you know, I try to do as the surgeon, especially when we're dealing with colorectal problems and colorectal cancers, is I essentially become somewhat of the quarterback, or my partners who are also colorectal surgeons. And I think a lot of the places that deal with colorectal cancer would argue that the colorectal surgeon becomes sort of the point person. So I try to get people to understand that. And, you know, I tend to be the point of communication for a lot of these patients, as well as, you know, one of the final decision makers of whether or not surgery is appropriate or not. But there are a lot of moving parts with these most often. Now, a place like Guthrie at Robert Packer, we do have weekly discussions about colorectal cancer patients, so that we understand what is going on in the oncology office, what is going on in the radiation office, what's going on in my office. So that way, if something is either, you know, getting complicated, or, you know, we need help, or we think others should be involved, this is something that's moving in real time, and we're not losing days or weeks here or there, trying to get the ball rolling here. Because ultimately, I would love to be the one that could make a difference as soon as I can, you know, operate, move on, take care of it, but probably half the time there are other things that we would recommend are required to not only look further into this before we, you know, figure out a treatment plan, but maybe required to further optimize the long-term benefits of what seem to be, you know, straightforward. Most patients come to me and say, just cut it out.
Yeah.
It's not that easy sometimes. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. And to you know, render a service like that without all the other considerations would be maybe setting up for a very, very, very short-term success with a potential for a long-term problem. So there was a lot of dialogue and re-education that I think takes place sometimes, certainly in the era of information being at our fingertips and, you know, web forums and YouTube and things like that. I think a lot of people, not everybody, but some individuals may come with their own preconceived notion of what's going to happen or should. And sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong. But these conversations are generally, you know, very fluid and dynamic. And you know, we just try to start from the ground and build up our understanding of what's to happen.
And you touched on this earlier, but I think just as a moment, we're talking about screening, but then, you know, there are certain organs and certain bodily functions that patients are sometimes, and humans sometimes, don't want to talk about. Right. And they don't want to recognize in the office, or in my office, they apologize. And I say, I have an 8 and a 10-year-old. We talk about bowel movements all the time. Like, it's just part of life. But what are those things? What are those red flags that are, I need to tell my doctor this, you know, I need to pursue something other than screening?
Sure. I think if I had to pick one thing that really makes set off the red flag, it's probably the most common thing, and it is more often a a simple explanation, but mm-hmm. most often I think some sort of blood loss, and that could be in the form of blood in your stool, mm-hmm. a low blood level that isn't explainable on a routine, you know, lab work. I think those things are really the biggest trigger mm-hmm. for really evaluating for this problem if you have not recently been looked at for it. Mm-hmm. Anemia, you know, tends to be the one element that is probably the most common when diagnosed and maybe coupled with some other symptoms, really does shunt people in a direction that really looks at the gastrointestinal system for the blood loss. Mm-hmm. And more often than not, may find something in the colon more so than the stomach or small intestine or esophagus mm-hmm. or anything like that. So I think some sort of blood loss certainly would cue me into thinking, okay, let's at least rule this out, because it's pretty, and we have a way of doing that. Now, not everybody with blood in their bowel movements or on the tissue paper when they wipe has colon cancer, but I think the odds are shifted in such a form that, you know, an older individual with new blood, it'd be best to look into it. I think less common, you know, changes to the way that one goes to the bathroom over the course of time. You know, if it used to be a regular once a day, every morning, soft, very, you know, very traditional in appearance, and now it's coming out very different consistently without any, you know, dietary changes or, you know, lifestyle changes. Mm-hmm. I think that's another indicator of something maybe within the system that is getting in the way. You know, less specific things like weight loss that is not intended, you know, bloating or particular pain that is persistent in one area of the abdomen can certainly be a cue for that. Mm-hmm. And then if you kind of pile these things together, I'm sure the suspicion really rises probably, yeah. you know, like that. But most, I would say most are asymptomatic. They're found when looking for something else, perhaps, mm-hmm. or they're found incidentally on you know, a scan or blood work for something else. But mm-hmm. But certainly when your body tells you something, it's worth listening to, you know, or bringing up to your primary care physician or provider.
Yeah.
Okay. I have one last question, mm-hmm. and it's not a serious question at all. So now, is it true that people tend to get a little bit of loopy when they're coming out of these? And do you get to witness this, or are you jealous because your team witnesses it because you're on to the next thing?
I people do. And it's funny when I see people, you know, a week or two later to review information or kind of, you know, figure out the next steps, it's like a different person. And, the anesthesia that I'm most often around, isn't as funny as the social media videos of people saying those sort of darndest things, but it is funny that what people really fixate on in that recovery area. I don't see it very often. I'm typically moving on to the next thing after making sure they're safely recovering. But I'm sure it's a hoot and a half if you can get people to, you know, kind of persist on their fixations.
And another benefit to volunteering to being the driver, right? Yeah. for your family member or friend who needs a driver for their colonoscopy.
I had a patient recently, you know, I see people in Sarah, Pennsylvania. So it's not infrequent. I have people coming from, you know, all directions. And I had this patient coming from, you know, Endicott, Binghamton area. And he said, you know, I just can't wait to go to the Tioga Downs, the casino here, to their buffet. And I tell them, I said, do not go to the casino. You know, we tell people, do not shop online and do not, you know, go to the casino if you're going to the buffet, because your inhibitions are still lifted. It's like, you know, and that's just the thing that we try and, you know, guard against, because we can't be liable for that, you know, major life change.
All right. Well, Dr. Sarniak, unless there's anything else you'd like to add, you know, we just want to thank you for your time. It's mm-hmm. been a great conversation.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thanks for having me. The one little parting thought, just to reiterate mm-hmm. a couple of things that I said, I, you know, for patients listening or providers, you know, with guidance for patients. I do think something is better than nothing. And if it is an annual fit test, or if you're able to, you know, have a Cologuard, you know, test or something like that, certainly at least, you know, doing some due diligence is worth it. And the other thing is, you know, I tell the residents and students that I work with, you know, there is certainly something happening to maybe make this influence younger individuals, whereas 20 years ago, we really didn't see that same number. Mm-hmm. And the projections are only looking at it rising in younger individuals. You know, and Dr. Johnston will probably reinforce this, but I think a lot of this really just starts with, you know, diet and exercise, healthy mm-hmm. habits. You know, trying to really make them a foundation of your day, because I'm sure, you know, years of eating, you know, processed foods, mm-hmm. years of being exposed to, you know, cigarette smoke, other toxins on a molecular level,
yeah.
really has changed kind of our biology in some way. Now, this is speculation, perhaps, but I don't know, because I see people my age, grew up in my generation, kind of going through, you know, these struggles. And, you know, one of the best things that an individual can do for themselves is to really take care of themselves from the, you know, ground up, just to try and prevent issues down the line. So that's just my little thought that I kind of pepper in there with patients from time to time. But
yeah, primary prevention. Well,
yeah.
We're not great at it as a culture. We're not, yeah. But we certainly can make small gains as we go.
Right.
Yep.
All right. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you, too.
Well, Steve, I feel like we had a great podcast today with Dr. Cerniak. Certainly provided us with a lot of great information. And I think some of those parting points. So one, it starts with prevention, right? What can I do to prevent myself from being in a high-risk category? Lifestyle changes, healthy diet, exercise, avoiding things that we know can cause cancers. Two, screenings. Screenings are pushed so hard because we know that a disease is either preventable or very easily treatable when caught early. I think colon cancer is a great example of that. When caught early, easily treatable, much better outcomes. And then the third thing is, if you're having concerning symptoms, talk to your primary provider, right? Practitioner or physician, about those symptoms, because we may need to look further to determine where it's coming from.
Yes, exactly. And I know one thing, I am going to, as soon as we get off, well, maybe in a couple of minutes, couple of days, I'm going to go ahead and schedule my first ever colonoscopy. You know, I think it's definitely worth it. And, you know, yeah. it's going to make a difference. And if you have any questions out there, whether you're listening or watching, you know, we encourage you for answers to some of our simpler questions and medical advice. Check out Guthrie.org/engage for some great information, quizzes, all that kind of stuff. And one thing we haven't mentioned in a while, the great theme music, the Head, Shoulders, Knees, and Toes rendition that we've been listening to every week, that is courtesy of the Modern Band program at Cortland High School. If you have a musical program and you'd like to get your shot at recreating a Head, Shoulders, Knees, and Toes, just shoot us an email at corporate_communications@guthrie.org. We'd love to spotlight your band as well. All right. Have a great week, Dr. Johnston.
Bye, Steve. Take care.